Hi there.
Hey, Matt.
Hi, I'm Matthew Iglesias. I'm a fellow and a blogger at the Center for American Progress.
And I'm Isaac Chotiner. I'm a writer and editor at The New Republic. And
We
I
both
think
have long
we
history
first
with blogging heads.
we do. I think we met when I was a technician for Blogging Heads, and I filmed you on an early episode. If I think
Yes.
that's right.
Yes. Sounds right. Sounds right. But
Yeah.
now things are so much more advanced.
Indeed, indeed. We've made it so far since then.
Strides. Yes. So I guess we should have planned this better. Should we talk about basketball first?
I think that would be a good starting point, yeah, given our interests.
Okay, right. Yes. Basketball. Basketball. It's been the world, the landscape has shifted
It certainly has.
with a new monster rising in Miami.
Yeah, although you seem to be slightly more positive about this or less critical of LeBron James than other people. Maybe you want to first start and say exactly what happened and then
Right.
say your take on it.
Well, so of course what's happened is for a couple of years now, people have been waiting for this free agent season when LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh would all become free agents. And a number of teams have been, really structuring their decisions around trying to create the space to sign some of those guys. And ultimately all three wound up signing with the Miami Heat. Which is kind of a big deal. And LeBron himself announced this decision in the course of a sort of tasteless hour-long ESPN spectacle.
You could say it. You could say that, yes.
But this then led to a sort of an orgy of anti-LeBron outpourings that I thought got really sort of over the top, and in particular from the owner of the Cavaliers, who, I understand he's a businessman, and he doesn't want his most valuable employee to leave the team. But I wish people were a little more skeptical of the kind of like stark moralistic terms that Dan Gilbert and others present this in. Gilbert's idea seemed to be that because the draft lottery gave LeBron no choice but to sign with Cleveland several years ago, that he's under some kind of, ethical obligation to continue to work
Right.
for Dan Gilbert, no
Right.
matter what happens. And I think, obviously, the fortunes of multimillionaire NBA players is, not a really pressing political and social concern. But there is a kind of important, political principle, I think, at work, which says that, people, employees should be able to, go take their talents to South Beach if that's what they want to do. That,
Right.
the idea, businessmen and employers do not show that kind of sentimentality and loyalty about people. I mean, including in the sports world, which obviously it's a business that's infused with sentimentality, but these things are run as businesses. Tickets are, soda costs a ton at basketball stadiums because it's
Right.
business.
Well, I think that that's right. But I think, I think there are a few different things here. The first is that you're absolutely right that the outrage about this has gotten a little out of control. I was watching ESPN the day after it happened, and they had on some reporters from Cleveland newspapers who were saying gleefully that LeBron would never be able to set foot in Cleveland again, and that his whole entire extended family would have to move out of the city,
Right.
if not the state of Ohio. And you
Right.
sort of want to say, well, we live in America. People can live where they want. And it was sort of vaguely menacing and threatening, which was a little bit insane.
Also, I'm not sure that
Obviously,
losing the ability to live in Cleveland is like the greatest penalty that could be extracted from someone.
that's true. That's true. That could have been LeBron's plan all along, was that he'd have to sell his house in Cleveland or
Yeah.
Akron, where I think he lives or where he's from.
Yeah.
I think that Dan Gilbert's over-the-top rant certainly was amusing, but it was a little bit insane. And I think about 80% of the outrage you're seeing from people in Cleveland would have happened regardless of whether LeBron decided to announce it on Twitter the way players are doing now, or whether he
Right.
decided to announce it in sort of an overlong ESPN ridiculous spectacle. I do think that there were certain things about the way in which he went about it that were you know, disgraceful is a strong word, but first off, just starting and, you know, just demanding ESPN that they give him the show, although I guess he didn't have to demand much since they got incredible ratings for it. And then surrounding himself with kids, which is always sort of a low way of, you know, making any decision that you know you're going to get heat for, is you surround yourself with poor kids and say, look how much I care.
Sure.
But I think really the worst part of it was ESPN's role in this. And, you know, sports journalists don't have the same responsibility that, say, political journalists do or foreign correspondents. But it was really a network prostituting itself for ratings to go indulge in this ridiculous spectacle. And the network itself, of course, hyped it up for the days leading up to it. And so that was sort of something that I think for people like us who do care about sports journalism and take it with some seriousness, that was maybe the worst part of it.
Right. No, I mean, I agree with that. But I do think it's part of what, you know, ESPN is such a dominant player in sports media that this itself became, you know, sort of part of the problem that you have, you know, Bill Simmons, who's a writer who I like and I read regularly, sort of denouncing, you know, the spectacle in his ESPN column, but making it out as if somehow LeBron James had forced, you know, all of his colleagues and his employers to go create this. But, you know, I mean, obviously it was done. LeBron, I mean, say what you will about the sort of goofiness of, you know, trying to use children to shield himself from criticism. But, you know, my understanding is that LeBron was, you know, in fact, donating money to charity there, whereas, you know, the Walt Disney Corporation, you know, they're just making money. And, you know, I mean, that's sort of who was, you know, behind this. On that kind of level. But I mean, I wonder, you know, I mean, you know, ethics is fun and all, but what about the basketball here? I mean, what do you think? What do you think this team?
Well, I will say I wasn't completely turned against rooting against Miami now that they have these three great players, or I should say two great players and one very good player.
Right.
But at their press conference the next day, which was sort of this giant fiesta with music and it was a scene for people who haven't seen what the Heat put on, the show they put on for LeBron and Wade and Chris Bosh. LeBron seemed to imply that the three of them were so good that even if they took Pat Riley, who is the general manager of the Heat, and who played basketball at Kentucky probably 40 years ago, 35 years ago, that even with him, they could still win a championship.
Right.
That's when I thought to myself, okay, we really need to see these guys go down. They really need to suffer for this. My sense is that they will be extremely good because the fact that they've got these three players, they'll be able to pull in some really good veterans from other teams who are willing to take less money for the chance to win, you know, potentially win a championship. Mm-hmm. But I also think that they have no interior defense and they really do need other players. And if they can't get any other good players because they're already salary cap wise at the limit, then I do think that they could very well lose to a team, you know, like Boston that has great defense and works hard and is full of talented players. But what do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the specific problem here is going to be that, you know, if you want to beat the Orlando Magic and you want to beat the Los Angeles Lakers, you need a player who can play defense against Dwight Howard, against Pau Gasol. I don't think that there's a player like that available to them on the free agent market right here. You know, that you could have a really, really good team based on these guys because, you know, relatively few teams can really kill you inside, but a few teams can. And I don't think that the Heat will be able to stop that. That said, you know, you could imagine them winning 60 games this year, losing in the Eastern Conference Finals, and then next season, you know, using the mid-level exemption, getting some, you know, just like a, you know, like a strong guy who plays defense, and, you know, not,
you don't need
star caliber players around these guys, but you need, you know, players who defend, who rebound, who are durable, like that. And you can get them over a couple of years.
It does take a while for teams to click also too. And so when they start playing together, they're not going to be as good as they will be after they've played together for 18 months.
Right.
And so I think their future 2 years from now is better than it is this coming season.
Right.
The
big winner in this arrangement, though, it seems to me, is Chris Bosh, who, I mean, I think everyone...
Who looked like a kid in a candy store, as you pointed out.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like everyone who's not Chris Bosh recognizes that, I mean, he's good. He's a very good basketball player, but he's not nearly as good as those other two guys.
I saw a hilarious interview with Bosh where they asked him, sports writers are obsessed with asking who's going to take the final shot of a game.
Right.
This is like a big question, you know, can you have like one like alpha dog on a team, or can you have two alpha dogs on a team? Well, that's group chemistry. They asked Chris Bosh who was going to be taking the final shot of the game. Mm-hmm. And Bosh said, well, some nights it'll be LeBron, some nights it'll be Wade, some nights it'll be me. And I thought to myself, no, Chris Bosh is not going to get a single final shot.
Right.
You know, but no, he does come out of this, you know, with $110 million and he's going to be a superstar.
Yeah, I mean, since he's buddies with these guys, apparently they like, you know, constructed this conceit whereby, like, the three of them are all equally good and are going to make the same amount of money. Which,
as
is
you know, as
crazy.
You know from our industry, Matt, becoming friends with people who are more talented than you is a way to move up in the world.
No, it is.
And so Chris Bosh has done that, and I think we should tip our hat to him.
It's excellent. And you know, as you know, I'm going to do a clever transition here. You know, just being a sort of a secondary player on great teams is a great way to sort of, you know, raise your profile above where talents would necessarily make it, which I was reminded of when I was in China recently, and Bruce Bowen.
Yeah, that was a smooth transition.
Bruce Bowen was visiting the country, and people were lining up to meet Bruce Bowen and have him sign their, I don't know, posters and stuff.
You should probably say before we move to your trip to China, which was going to be our second topic, that Bruce Bowen was a extremely good defensive player who played on the San Antonio Spurs, but was not a particularly flashy player who was even known in the United States by anyone except very big NBA fans, and was also famous for being a particularly dirty player. But anyway.
Exactly. But he's big in China, apparently, or they're just starved for visits from NBA players.
Well, NBA fever in China, I gather, is it's always impressive that the top-selling jerseys in the world are all players on the Houston Rockets, and that's only because Yao Ming...
Yeah,
on the Houston Rockets.
Although they seem, it's interesting just as an American basketball fan to visit a country where basketball is actually the most popular sport.
Right.
You know, obviously they spend a lot of time watching, like, I guess Chinese basketball games. But you know, there's like I couldn't understand anything since I don't know Chinese and don't know what's going on. But you would like see it on television all the time. You know, shows about basketball players and games and things like that. They love it. And you kind of feel bad because they're short.
Yeah, yeah. Although as someone who plays basketball and is not 6 feet tall, I have sympathy. But we should talk about your trip to China, which you went on, I guess, about 6 weeks ago, and you blogged about, and I guess you were saying it's changed your opinion in certain ways about China, or will you...
You try not to reach, you know, sweeping conclusions based on, like, a 10-day, junket someplace. But it is interesting to see certain things, you know, firsthand, that, like, you can kind of look up, well... You know, what's the productivity in different sectors of the Chinese economy? And you'll see that the service sector is much less productive than the industrial sector. But, you know, what does that really mean? But you go someplace and you can actually see it. You know, it's a little bit hard to describe exactly what the mechanism is. But like if you just like go to, you know, like a shop in the airport and you're trying to like get online with people and go to the cash register and buy soda. You can see that it's all for some, you know, it's like way more anarchic than it would be in the United States. The cashiers don't like process people quite as effectively. Nobody quite knows what they're doing. And you can see that it's sort of a consequence, I think, of the country having developed so quickly, you know, that an enormous amount of sort of physical structures are being built and new things are being created and people are being pulled into the workforce to do this stuff. But they don't, because things have changed so quickly, people don't necessarily have the experience with it in practice that you would expect. You know, like you have people working as concierges in fancy hotels, but they probably never traveled and stayed at hotels, you know, in their lives. And so a lot of the kind of the human element, you know, is sort of off kilter.
Well, so when you were on like a junket, as you said, did you sort of have like a minder who was traveling with you, or how did that work, or were you guys sort of on your own?
No, it was like a multi-layered series of monitoring. It was the trip was paid for by something called the U.S.-China Exchange Foundation, which exists in Hong Kong, where many things exist that are, you know, sort of more independent from the government. There's more sort of freedoms there. But then it was sort of co-organized with something called the Chinese People's Institute for Foreign Affairs, which, again, everyone assured us is an independent organization, although you can tell from the name that it's not that independent. So people from sort of both of those organizations were along with us the whole time. And then usually when we would come to a specific city, someone would be sent by the local municipal government. So it was very much an exercise in being, you know, led around to see what other people wanted us to see. You know, obviously it's not a totalitarian society. It's not like visiting North Korea or something. People, you know, talk about this and that. But it's also definitely not, you know, a typical view of the country or what's going on.
Did you have interactions with either with your minders or with sort of quote unquote average people while you were there much, or was it sort of more, there was a program and you sort of stuck to it?
No, I mean, you know, there was a lot of interactions with different kinds of people, students at universities, things like that, but still it was I'm not sure how many of them were genuinely average people. I mean, people tended to be, I think, drawn more from the elite classes, the people who we saw and interacted with.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see some of their attitudes. You know, I mean, I think in America, you know, we like to think that sort of all good flavors will go together, and that China should be freer and more democratic, and also that Tibetans should be better treated, and also that Taiwan should be allowed to, you know, sort of go its own way. But everybody who we spoke to was, you know, really strongly nationalistic, which I guess shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, average Americans are extremely nationalistic. And, you know, if they had any kind of disagreement with government policy on things like Tibet and Taiwan, it was that they thought it should be more hardline.
Right.
You know, and that's a, I mean, you hear that. I mean, you hear that from people who know the country much better than I do, you know, people who've lived there for years. But it is one of the things where sort of seeing it, you know, like in people's eyes, right? In, right. In their faces as they're talking about the Dalai Lama is a, you know, it's a striking.
Well, I mean, I think that we shouldn't transition quite yet to our next subject.
Sure.
You see that too, you know, in India and Pakistan. I've never been to Pakistan, but talking to Pakistanis and Indians that, you know, young Pakistanis and Indians who are very liberal on social issues, who want their countries to be more responsive to their democratic institutions at whatever strength they happen to be at. When you start to ask them about, say, Kashmir, then you sort of go, whoa, you know. So that I think that's something that's definitely – we all have a desire to sort of think that people will be – what we determine to be consistent.
Well, of course,
it's more complicated than that.
Well, and I think it should make everyone in America at least try to be a little bit more – you know, self-critical about what's taken to be common sense, you know, in this country, right? That people who, when you talk to them, you know, Chinese people, foreigners in general, when you talk to them about abstract issues, you know, is democracy good, you know, freedom, blah, 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 they seem totally reasonable, rational people. And then you talk to them about nationalist hot button issues, and suddenly it seems like they're lunatics. But you have to wonder,
how should we as Americans respond to that, you're saying?
Well, I mean, I think that we need to, at least everyone needs to consider a little bit how, you know, what is America's own version of that, right?
Right. Right.
You know, like what is it that you know, to Americans just sort of seems natural, but to other people looks like kind of bizarre nationalism.
I would agree. I would also say, though, that people like you or other people who take pleasure and do it well, criticizing bizarre American nationalism, should feel free to do it about other countries too.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that.
But yeah, no, I agree. I agree that it should be a cause for reflection about who we are as Americans. It should also, but that doesn't make it any more, you know.
Yeah, well, and of course it's true that I mean, you have to sort of take these critiques seriously on all sides. That, I mean, there is just very widespread nationalistic impulses. The United States is a lot more powerful than any other country and has sort of much more practical ability to act out on those kind of instincts. You know, in good ways and bads. I mean, in ways that both makes us the subject of disproportionate, you know, moralized criticism, but also more objectively, you know, dangerous than other countries might be. You know, if Argentinians have really kind of extreme opinions about this or that, it, you know, it sort of doesn't matter.
I mean, the British government ends their regime, as happened 25 years ago. Well, I was wondering, you had an interesting post. There's a new book out, which we reviewed on the website I run at the New Republic, the book about North Korea by this guy B.R. Myers. And neither of us are experts in North Korea, but the thesis of the book is that North Korea is not really a Stalinist state. It's actually a right-wing state. And it's true that it uses propaganda that, you know, taken from Imperial Japan and so on and so forth, and it's sort of a race-based right-wing state. And at a certain level, it gets ridiculous to talk about whether a country is right-wing or left-wing.
Right.
But I was interested that you, about China, had an interesting post when you were there, I think, about to what degree China is a communist country and to what degree it makes sense to call it a communist country, beyond the fact that it's run by the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think, I mean, obviously there are sort of limits to how seriously you should take this. But, you know, it's become, it's like conventional wisdom, I think, at this point in the West, that the idea that it's called the People's Republic of China and that they're called the Communist Party of China is like a joke. You know, like people sort of laugh if you talk about it. You know, and I was trying to say that we should take it at least a little bit more seriously, that in a lot of ways, you know, if you look at what they're doing, the government continues to control really substantial portions of the economy and of what Lenin called the commanding heights, quote unquote, in particular, finance, transportation, and communications. Or if you read the sort of 10-point program that comes at the end of the Communist Manifesto, some of it is very common sense stuff, like there should be a progressive income tax and children should go to school, you know, that everyone thinks. Some of it is like really odd, like we should establish industrial armies to work in agriculture, which it's hard to say what it says. But the specific point that it says is they want abolition of private property in rural land ownership, right? So confiscate property from big landowners and state monopolies on banking, communications, and transportation, which is basically what they have in China. It's also true that the Soviet Union, and at an earlier point in its history, China went much, much further than that, and, you know, and had, you know, the state running department stores and things like that. But that wasn't, I think, you know, I mean, there's a credible case to be made, at least, that that kind of thing is not, you know, integral to what Marxist policymaking was supposed to be about. The upshot of that is just that we shouldn't simply assume that because China has reformed a lot, that there's an intention to continue reforming it, even on the economic plane, all the way to something that, you know, we would find recognizable as a, you know, American style of capitalism.
Right, right. And it's interesting, I guess you probably didn't get a sense of this when you were there just because of what you saw, but the labor unrest that's happened, I guess, at a few Honda plants and at factories that are mostly foreign-owned, I think, is where it's happened.
Yes.
But it does shine a light on the fact that China doesn't really have labor unions the way we conceive of them, right, in terms
yeah.
of...
Yeah. Right. I mean, they have some kind of... I mean, on one level, they have much more unionization than we do because they're communists, but they're kind of factory unions.
Right.
What I thought was interesting about this that I did see being there was that when I read, you know, news coverage of these strikes in New York Times and BBC, I kind of assumed that this was the sort of thing that China's, like, state-run media would be covering up or hiding or something. But instead, it seemed to be quite extensively covered. I can't read Chinese, obviously, so I don't...
Is it because it's foreign-owned companies?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, I could only speculate, but it yeah. seemed like a deliberate decision was made that these strikes against foreign-owned manufacturing companies were something that the Chinese government was fine with and that they wanted to position themselves, at least, as on the side of the workers getting better
right.
conditions and better pay, which makes, I mean, it makes perfect sense when you think about it, but it ran a little bit contrary to my expectation of what sort of thing would happen. I mean, the government talks a lot about, they say they're building a harmonious society, what they say, which made me think that they were going to be trying to sort of just sweep under the rug any kind of discontent. But instead, you know, they seem to be trying to say that, yes, you know, these Taiwanese-owned and Japanese-owned companies should be paying people more.
Right, right. Well, should we transition to a country you're more positive about than China?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not. I don't know anything about India, really. But going to China made me think more that, you know, not that I want us to, you know, try to initiate a round of great power conflict where we try to like build up an Indian counterweight to China or something like that. But it made me kind of. I don't know, sad or upset or whatever, to continually hear stuff about how, well, you know, you could see that China's doing so much better than India and therefore, you know, democracy doesn't work or democracy doesn't work for developing countries or something like that. It made me definitely think that Americans should be trying to do more to help India, that it's seen as a, you know, an important test case for, like, values that we believe in.
Right. I mean, you did get the sense that during the Bush administration that there was more of a desire to have a close American relationship with India. But you also got the sense that the Bush people didn't really have a way of thinking about that beyond this nuclear deal,
right.
which was passed, I think, in 2006 or 2007, and which was very controversial in Pakistan and even both in India and I guess it was less controversial in the Senate, which ratified it. But but you did get the sense that there was sort of this desire for a closer American-Indian relationship. And, you know, Steve Call of The New Atlantic, who I think you've mentioned a few times, has written about how the Prime Minister of India, who is a man named Manmohan Singh, who is a Sikh prime, their first Sikh prime minister, and it is gotten a lot of credit among a lot of Americans, certainly, and also Indians, for doing a really terrific job and for being underrated at it, and for being sort of one of the few really first-rate world leaders. And I think you blogged about this recently. That
yeah, I mean, I just happened to see a story about how he was, you know, like lots of leaders nowadays, you know, facing some kind of budgetary issues, but that specifically he was trying to take on, you know, these kind of like fossil fuel subsidies that are really endemic in the world, but especially in developing countries where it has a, I mean, there's a very regressive impact to subsidizing gasoline in a country where the vast majority of people, as I understand it, you know, can't afford cars at all. But, you know, there's just a story about a political controversy about that. And it reminded me of what Steve Cole had written last winter.
It's a weird situation in India now, which is that Singh's coalition is sort of allied against both the right and the left. Singh comes from a Congress party, which I guess is generally considered the more left of the two major parties.
Right.
But it's the right wing has sort of opposed him on the nuclear deal. They've opposed him on these fuel subsidies. And then you have all these sort of smaller left-wing parties that range from sort of historically important in India's history, which has always had like a Marxist tradition and so on, to being just completely out of their minds.
Uh-huh.
And so Singh has been sort of allied, has been, he and his coalition have been sort of against both sides and has faced a lot of heat both on the nuclear deal and both on these fuel subsidies that you were saying and on all sorts of different things. And, you know, I think that it's interesting in terms of, for Americans, at least, his news coverage is very positive. He's thought of as being this very responsible, good leader, which I think basically he is. You know, in India, he's seen a little bit as a puppet because he's part of the Congress Party, which is historically the Nehru Party, which is India's first prime minister, and his family have basically controlled the party for 60-some years.
And he was brought in because the family, sort of family dynasty had passed to a woman who's actually Italian, right?
Right, who was married to Rajiv Gandhi, who was Nehru's grandson, and who was killed in the early 90s, and she is not going to become prime minister. She's Italian. And she's still the head of the Congress Party, though, and her son is sort of thought of as the next leader, even though nobody knows anything about him. He, like, travels around on a helicopter and gives speeches and I guess he's young and good-looking, but other than that, nobody knows anything about him, but everyone says, oh, of course he'll be the next prime minister. So it's certainly important that for the Congress Party and for India that they can have a leader of Congress that is Congress the party, not the parliament, that is not part of this dynasty. But at the same time, I think a lot of people in India still don't think that he doesn't quite have the power to do whatever he wants. I mean, I think that's probably somewhat overstated, and I think Steve Cole, when he wrote about this, one of the things he was applauding Singh for his steps on Kashmir, which has lately come back into the news for sort of exploding but in the last couple of days. But, you know, and Singh did take a couple of really serious steps on Kashmir, unfortunately, to try to make a deal with Pervez Musharraf when he was in charge of Pakistan. The problem that you see now again with sort of India sending more troops back into Kashmir to sort of enforce some sort of martial law, now that rioting has gotten to be a big deal again as it flares up from time to time, you sort of see that the Indian state is so entrenched in certain ways in places like Kashmir, and that Singh as prime minister, there is only so much he can do.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, anyway, he struck me as an interesting kind of figure, you know, particularly for sort of Americans who, you know, like me, are kind of, you know, on the left, but think of ourselves, but, you know, I mean, center left type people, that this is a country where the sort of, with those kind of ideas that you know, I adhere to, and that, you know, I think a lot of people I know adhere to, have a kind of more vitality and relevance than they do right now in the developed world, where, you know, the sort of politics is more open, there's much more possibilities, the scope of changes is much bigger, and that this is something that sort of deserves more attention, and also just that the country as a whole really does. There's a kind of I feel like when we think about the developing world in the U.S., there's a tendency to sort of skip from, like, China, which is the kind of exciting but possibly threatening, you know, growth and like they're hosting the Olympics and, you know, everything's great. And then to like skip down to Africa where, you know, it's depressing and everyone's super poor and it's like a charity case and we need to talk about AIDS and malaria and stuff. And kind of, you know, between the two on the economic scale and also sort of geographically, you know, is India and a billion plus people and, you know, right. substantial economic growth and real progress being made, but also not nearly at the pace that's taking place in China, but with a government that, I mean, not just in terms of the person who's currently prime minister, but an entire political system that's much more congenial to, you know, our values and what we see ourselves as being all about.
Right. I mean, I think that there, it sort of runs both ways, and that you're right that the system is more open in the way that people with really varying ideas run, and it makes the contrast in Indian Parliament between people, the different opinions people have versus, say, Democrats and Republicans about certain
right.
things. But at the same time, it's really, really hard to sort of change things at a
right.
bureaucratic level in India. You know, Tom Friedman's gotten some I don't know if I can swear. Tom Friedman's gotten some criticism for writing these articles about China saying, you know, oh, China, they can transition to a green economy because they just
right.
snap their fingers and, you know, the bureaucracy works because it's a one-party state and so on.
Right.
And which I'm sure is true, but at the same level, you don't want to live in a one-party state.
Right.
India is sort of the opposite, which is that you do have people running and you do have sort of different ideas about the direction that the Indian state should go. And I think that the Congress Party at the moment, like, more or less has the right balance of development and caring for the poor, and certainly poverty statistics in India are heartening in all sorts of ways. But at the
right.
same time, it's just incredibly hard to make changes. And if you talk to Indian people, they'll just tell you that just to get anything to happen from the bureaucracy is just ridiculous and it's corrupt and you have to bribe people. And,
right.
It really, which I'm sure is true in China too, but it's really horrific.
Right. Right. And I mean, I do think, you know, one thing that they've been sort of able to do in China is cultivate the idea that the top leadership of China is aware that corruption is a big problem and that they are trying to crack down. And so people
right.
Have a tendency to conceptualize it in these kind of, you know, if only the king knew kind of terms.
Right.
You know, which obviously is on many levels just propaganda, but has, I guess, some kinds of truth to it. Whereas, you know, you see in the United States, right? I mean, when in a democratic country, you see politicians proposing things and counter-proposing and the policies don't change because of veto points in the system, people become extremely frustrated, you know, not
right.
just at the bad actors, but at the sort of the underlying system as well. And
right.
you know, and that's, I mean, behind a lot of what Tom Friedman's been writing, and, you know, it's a sentiment I do sympathize with, that you're seeing an American political system where it's just overwhelmingly difficult to make large changes, even when you have, you know, a reasonable amount of consensus about the direction that the change needs to be taken. I think, you know, I think people should be more careful than he has been about expressing admiration for the idea that unelected autocrats are the way to go. But there's something to be said, I think, for something like the British political system, where elections lead to, you know, much more decisive outcomes and where governments can, you know, move in really bold ways with then the knowledge that they'll need to stand accountable to the electorate for the results of that.
Right. No, it's been funny watching this British coalition in power because it sort of what you're saying seems to be true, and yet the British feel that their system is unaccountable and that their elections are unfair in all these sorts of ways, and they're trying to
right.
reform it. So it's sort of an interesting contrast, but it's true when you watch the Senate, for instance, and then you turn to Britain where they have a coalition government between two parties that are ideologically, you know, do not mix in all sorts of ways, and it just seems like it's easier to get things done. I mean,
right.
it's...
Well, and I would just say, I mean, you know, I mean, there's no perfect system. But insofar as people are frustrated, you know, with the Senate or with, you know, the Indian bureaucracy or whatever else, you know, afflicts democratic countries, it's probably better to look to something like the United Kingdom rather than China, you know, right. as an example of how you can make the government more decisive. Because right. it's, I mean, whatever you may say, it's not like the part where they have to, where they have free speech and elections, that, you know, I mean, the that doesn't actually stop British politicians from striking out in bold new directions. British people, I think, well, you know, people always see the grass as greener on the other side. And in Britain, I guess there's a lot of feeling that, you know, it's too easy for political leaders to just kind of, you know, futz around and, you know, very occasionally stand for election.
Right, right. No, I think that that's right, although I think that probably was not true until Thatcher, that feeling among the British
right.
public. But,
right.
Well, should we transition to our final topic, which was this David Brooks column on Friday?
Yeah, books.
Well, so David Brooks wrote this column on Friday in the New York Times saying that the title was a little confusing, but the gist of the column was that basically by sort of transitioning to reading online and reading, I guess, both ebooks and both just more online reading
right.
rather than actually reading books,
right.
The physical books, that something was being lost, and he trotted out some studies saying sort of that kids who actually had interactions with real books were I guess, scoring better. They weren't seeing a slide in their summer reading scores
right.
or whatever the testing was. And Brooks, or someone he quoted in the piece, was theorizing that when children have books, it sort of makes them feel like a reader in some broader sense
mm-hmm.
than a reader in a broader sense than just someone who's actually reading, but that you're part of something.
Right.
Community would be the wrong word, but that you're sort of part of a society that values this, and it's sort of a good feeling. And I think that intuitively, at least, that seems right in the sense that anyone who sort of owns books and loves
right.
the books that they own, which I think is you know, certainly a lot of people, can sort of see what he's talking about. But what did you think about the column?
You know, I think, you know, I feel like this is the kind of subject that newspaper columns don't deal with very well. That Brooks had a kind of a mishmash of like good ideas and kind of wrong-headed ones. You know, and I'm not sure that kind of what you were talking about at the end, a sort of like semi-mystical view of this is the right way to think about it. You know, what I think what's definitely true is that as it gets easier because of digital media to just switch, you know, to say, I'm reading this, now I'm reading that. To say, when I went to China, I carried on my iPad something like 25 different books, which you never could have done. I mean, it would have been impractical to carry so many physical books. And I also still spend a lot of time reading the internet, and I obviously didn't read 25 books during those 10 days. And that's a huge advantage in so many ways. But it does mean that the cost involved in saying, I'm going to sit down and grapple with a really weighty tome, has gotten much higher. You know, I mean, a few years ago, if you were going to go someplace for that long, if you had trans-Pacific flights and you knew you couldn't lug 25 books around with you, you know, you might pick up Moby Dick or Brothers Karamazov, or, you know, because you're saying, well, you know, I need something big that's gonna take a long time to read. And in the future, people will have access to much more information than people of a generation ago did. But people aren't going to want to sit down with the real sort of big thunking books. And so that, I mean, there's lots.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right. I mean, you know, I think generally speaking that the more people read, the better, right?
Right.
And so if Oprah's book club, which seems like kind of a silly thing to me, tells people to read War and Peace, and this means that a million Americans read War and Peace one summer, terrific. That seems great. And if people read more books because they can take War and Peace along with 24 other books on their Kindle when they go to China, and so they end up reading more books than they would have otherwise, that also seems great. I do think, you know, that there is something lost. I mean, I certainly notice it myself. you know, Nicholas Carr has this new book about what the internet is doing to our brains, right. And I certainly notice it with my own reading, and I have to read a lot for work and try to read a lot for pleasure, right. And I definitely feel like starting and finishing a really long book is something that is harder to do than it was for me when I was younger.
Right.
Because you do sort of get distracted, and there's a way in which, and again, I used the word mystical before, I want to stay away from that, but there is a way in which it's hard to put my finger on, but it does feel like that the sort of, that the internet and technology has made engaging with big, serious books, and just generally with whole books, books in their complete
right.
books, to be, just the idea of picking up a book, which is generally a pretty substantive thing, has made that more difficult.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, I just think it's important to be sort of clear and for people to understand that, I mean, that it's a loss, but it's a loss that's coming about, you know, because we're gaining something that I think it's sometimes construed as like, oh, you know, people have all these gizmos now, so we're becoming dumb and, you know, nobody can read War and Peace. Whereas I don't think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, I read War and Peace when I was an intelligent, but, you know, socially maladjusted, moody teenager. And so.
Which you still are now.
Sure, I'm older. You know, and, you know, I didn't have a girlfriend and whatever. So I was like reading this long ass book. And it was a good experience. You know, it's character building. And I don't think a similarly situated 17-year-old would necessarily do the same thing these days. They might be reading and writing political blogs or something. Unlikely is that, like, the exact same smart kid who would have read War and Peace 10 years ago is, like, now just going to play video games all the time. They'll probably do something else that's the kind of thing that, you know, smart people are interested in. And that, you know, I mean, it's that people have access to so much more stuff. And so what gets crowded out is these things that are really long, and there's a loss. And it's just like how, you know, over the years, like opera plays less and less of a role in our culture and society, because there are more and more ways to experience music, to experience drama. And so these kind of older forms become marginal. There's a loss to that, and it's bad. But at the same time, I think it would be like perverse to say, well, it's a bad thing that more genres of music exist now.
Right. I mean, without simply saying it's good or bad, I think that's right. And I think the kid who at 17 would have read War and Peace and is now doing something else is not going to turn out to be, you know, robbing a bank. You know, he'll be fine. He or she will be fine. I do think, though, that maybe you feel differently about this. I do feel like technology has certainly made life better in all sorts of ways, and one really truly wonderful ways. I do feel like, though, I am spending time wasting time where I couldn't waste time before, and that it's not just replacing War and Peace with, you know, doing something else on the internet that's interesting. It's replacing War and Peace with something that's really, really silly. And I do feel like when I was 17, or 14, and the internet was not really available, it was, but not
right.
down the way it is now, that I really didn't have the same opportunities to waste time. And I do sort of wonder if I had the internet at age 14 the way we do now, if whether
right.
much, much, much more of my time would have been wasted. But I agree with you. I mean, it's sort of like fighting against.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be interesting to look, though, you know, empirically at.
We don't want to. Well, talk
about no, no, no. I just mean
at the
role that television plays in this, you know, because
right.
I mean, one thing I do know is that I spend much less time than I used to, like watching bad TV shows or just like having low value TV experiences. Like I used to watch reruns of Seinfeld and The Simpsons all the time, because there were lots of reruns on, and I liked those shows. But I mean, it's not just that those shows aren't like high culture in its purest form. It's that it was literally episodes I had seen before. And so now, thanks to the internet, I think I watch less TV than I used to, but also thanks to TiVo and Netflix and things like that, when I am, you know, watching moving images on the screen, it's much more deliberate. I'm seeking out things that people say are good. I'm seeking out things I hadn't seen before. And I am, yeah, I mean, interacting with words and things on the web more. And so, you know, I mean, I'm not sure kind of which of those effects dominate.
No, that's true. There's also just better stuff on TV right. than there used to be. I mean, you know, there used to be five channels, and most shows were terrible, and now there's so many channels
from
that there are always a good TV show that you can rent on DVD and you can watch.
I think they've sort of had to raise their game, right? And so there's like no level of time wasting that I think can like quite equal, you know, the stupidity of like some of the sitcom watching I used to do. You know, I think you like actually can't find programs that bad anymore. So, you know, this, you know, there's a progress, as
and
well.
It's true. Watching less terrible TV is definitely something in the right direction. I actually felt that way watching the World Cup yesterday, which is I have not spent 2.5 hours watching something so bad and boring on TV since I was like 14. And, you know, this was a rare experience, and that was nice. Fortunately, the World Cup only happens every 4 years, so, you know.
Sure.
You don't have to waste your time as much.
Yes, I sort of agree.
Yeah, but we don't, you know, we'll be harassed if we bash soccer.
No, well, but see, people are just stop caring about even whether you're bashing soccer once the World Cup ends. That's the sort of the genius of it.
No, it's true. It sort of instantly, the one thing I noticed about, as someone who's not really a soccer fan, talking to a lot of soccer fans the last few days is that soccer fans, when they want to defend the sport to Americans like us who prefer sports like basketball, say, they first start out by saying, you know, oh, soccer is this game, it's beautiful, it has all these intrinsic qualities that, you know, Americans can't understand and American culture isn't equipped to handle and so on and so forth. And then if that argument fails, they go to the quick populist argument of, well, will more people like it? You know, well, look at the viewership. Look at how many people around the world like it. And, of course, this is the exact thing that Americans would be accused of saying
about
their sports
it's
watching.
Crass.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
they sucked
me in for the purposes of this tournament, though. I mean,
yeah, me too.
I watched,
me too.
You know, games that the United States was in and games that were on at sort of convenient times for me to watch.
Right.
So I do think, you know, I do think on some level they are getting... They're getting established, I mean, on a low rung of the American sports hierarchy, but, you know, as something that at least, like, people who like to follow sports, you know, will pay attention to, you know, when convenient.
I'd like to see that. I'm sure you can look up the viewership ratings. I wonder how soccer plays outside of large cities.
Right, that's true.
I mean,
it
in
could
Washington,
just be a
where
feat.
We live, and certainly in New York where I was for some of the games – you know, it does seem like a major event is going on when America's playing. I wonder if that's the same in, you know, Nebraska.
Yeah. True.
Well, I think we're at the end of our time.
Should we wrap it up?
Yeah.
Wrap it up with questions we don't know the answers to.
Exactly.
All right. Brilliant.
Well, it's been good talking to you, Matt.
Yeah, likewise.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.